Rabbi Kenneth Brander, May 1st, Sfirat HaOmer and the students of Rabbi Akiva learning from their death and the purpose of life.
Good morning, everyone. Can I ask some people maybe if they could just move up so we can get this thing a little bit more... a little bit more an intimate setting. I want to thank the students. We try at the CJS to empower students to put together programs. And our goal really is not for us to do the programs, but the students to do the programs. There's a group of students who are going to be going in the summer and actually raise funds for the projects that they're working on in Israel. There's a group of students going to Yerucham, Dimona, Arad, and Yamin Ord, four different places where children live beneath the poverty line. Yamin Ord actually is an orphanage where children have come from challenging homes or from the FSU or other places. And then there's another group of students, a group of Quest students who are working with JNF on various projects. And the goal is in each one of these, although, for example, when we go to these development towns, we transform the lives of hundreds and hundreds of teenagers and children there, but my goal really in all these programs is that they're incubators for our students to realize how they can change the world around them. And then there's another group of students who are going to be going throughout the United States running learning programs, including actually a woman's kollel that, please God, will be housed in Renat for the summer. So I want to thank you for opening your home, not only for this, but also opening your home please God, in the summer, and you'll join us. So I want to thank Shira and Margo and Jordan and Eliana for putting this together. And we'd like to share with you some ideas regarding the story of Sfirat HaOmer. Do you have the Makara? Yes, good. So the whole mitzvah of Sfirat HaOmer really starts from the Torah. We're all familiar with Sukkim in the Torah, that highlight the idea of counting between Pesach and Shavuot. In fact, Shavuot is the only Chag in the Torah that doesn't have a specific date. We're told it is X amount of days, right? X amount of days, 49 complete days, 50 days after the beginning of holiday of Pesach. We're told Shemesh Habachos Timimos Tiyana. It should be 7 complete weeks. Or Usfartam Lechemi Macharat HaShabbat. You should count from the day after the first day of Pesach. And so there is this movement from the physical redemption to the spiritual redemption that happens on Pesach, that from Pesach to Shavuot, that is accentuated in Sfirat HaOmer. But we're also familiar with the fact that there is a mourning overlay that happens to the whole Sfirat HaOmer period, and I'd like to discuss that overlay, because it's not one coherent overlay, and there are some interesting messages within that overlay, and hopefully we can get to the bottom of it over the course of the next, how long, 30 minutes or so? 35 minutes? 40 minutes or so, we can get through some of it. So let's look at our sources. Let's start with source A. Source number A is Bereishis Rabbah. I bring the Bereishis Rabbah before the Gemara on this issue for two reasons. First is it's an earlier source about the story. And secondly, you'll see it's a little bit different than the story in the Bible. Let's look at source A. We're told the following. Rabbi Akiva speaks about the idea, if you raise disciples in the youth, you should raise disciples in your old age. And the piece I want to get to is the second line of the Hebrew, Yud Beth Elef Talmidim Hayu Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 students. Okay? They lived throughout Israel. And on the third line, second word, v'kulam b'perek echad metu, they all died at one time. Lama, why? Shahita inehem tsara elu ve'elu. Because they didn't treat each other with respect. That's source number, that's the Bereishit Rabbah. Let's look at source number 2b, where the Gemara in Yevamos tells us, Shneim asar elav zugim tamidim. There weren't 12,000 students, so what does the Gemara tell us? What, 12,000. Actually, the Gemara doesn't say 24,000, and which is an important thing. It says 12,000 pairs. And that's an important message. Why doesn't it say 24,000? Why does it say 12,000 pairs? And they all, and Bekulam made two, Beperk Echa, they all died at one time, because they didn't treat each other with respect. Look at the last lines of this Gemara. It's almost like an addendum. Tana, a Braita tells us, or Tana taught us, Kulam Meitu V'Pesach Adaseret. Now is the first time, we're not told that they died from Pesach till Shavuot in the earlier story, in the Bereishis Rabbah story, but in this there is an addition that says they died from Pesach to Shavuot. Amar Rav, Chama Bar Abba V'Yisem Rav Chia Bar Avin, Kulam Meitu Misara. Not only did they die, but they died a horrible death. What is that death? Mahi Amar Rav Nachman Asakra, the death of Asakra, some type of throat disease that caused them to die. So immediately we see two differences between the Bavli and the earlier text of Bereishis Rabbah. Number one is 12,000 or 12,000 pairs. Number two is when did they die? The Bereishis Rabbah doesn't tell us when they died, it just says that they died. But the Gemara in Yevamos tells us that they died between Pesach and Shavuot and from some type of death. Let's look at the third source, or the next page, source C. And this is a later source. And what this source says is, Rabbi Akiva, Omer, Rabbi Akiva said, Shneim Asar Talmidim, Shneim Asar Alafim Talmidim Hayuli, I had 12,000 students, and they lived throughout Israel, V'kulam Meitu B'chayei, they all died in my lifetime. And when did they die? Between Pesach and Shavuot. Between Pesach and Shavuot. How is this source, Kohelet Rabbah, the later source, different than the first two? How's it different?
We're down to 12,000 again.
That's what he was speaking. And it's telling us that from Pesach to Shavuot. So it's a little bit cut and pasted from both of them, those sources. Doesn't completely follow the Gemara in Yevamos, doesn't completely follow the Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah. It's a little bit of each. Okay? Where? Source C. Okay. Source C. Okay. Just testing us. Okay? Now, let's look at the response literature of the Gaonim. The Gaonim are a group of rabbinic scholars and really Jewish leaders lived from the years like 700 CE to 900 CE. And they write the following. Usha'altem, we ask, Lama ein mekadshim vein kontzim vein Pesach v'Atzeres? Why isn't there any marriages between Pesach and Shavuot? Imach las iser or las? Is it forbidden or not? Havi yodim, we know. Shalom isum iser. It's not because it's forbidden. Ela mishum minhag avelut. It is a custom of mourning we have. Shekach amru chachamim, as our rabbi said, Shneimasar alafim zugim tamidim. There were 12,000 pairs. Hayula Rabbi Kiva, Bakula Mesum Bepesach Atzeres. They all died between Pesach and Atzeres. Achlo Nagu Zebazet. Because they didn't treat each other properly. And how did they die? They died from this crazy death, Asakra. So, Oto Sha'ah. That's the third line from the bottom of source D, second word. Ve'elech, Nagu Rishonim Beyam Me'elu Shalo Lichnos. Behen. That we have the minhag from the Rishonim that no one should get married during this time. Or Misha Kafat, the Kines, and somebody who did get married during this time, Einon Ukonsim, we don't punish them. Their marriage is a good marriage. We wish them mazel tov. We go to their Sheva Brachot. We send them a gift. Below Onesh, below Malkus, no type of punishment. Avo Imbab, if somebody asks you, should you make a wedding between Pesach and Shavuot? Ein Marim, we tell them not to. Well, the Inyan Kedushin, what about engagement? And here it's actually talking about more of a halachic engagement. And that is giving, saying Harei At Mekudesh at least, not doing the final piece, and that is the Sheva Brachot. Misha Rasa Mekadesh, Mepesach Latzeres Mekadesh. Whoever wants to get engaged between Pesach and Latzeres can, if he should aim Iker Simcha El Chopa. Because the real Simcha is the finality piece,
and that is the Nisuin, which is, takes place under the Chuppah. That same idea is highlighted by Rabbeinu Yerucham in the 1290s, or actually in the 1300s, where Rabbeinu Yerucham quotes Rav Hai Gon, again, lived towards the end of the Gaonic period, or the final one of the Gaonim, reminding us that the real prohibition of Sfirat HaOmer is not to get married. What don't you see about the Minhagim of Sfirat HaOmer? What don't you see in these early Gaonic texts?
Music.
No music. What other things don't you see?
Haircuts.
Correct. What else? Those two in particular. So the first thing is a little bit of an interesting piece here. The first thing is, you don't see some of the traditions that we have found in the earlier sources. The Torah also mentions this idea that the earlier sources really are particularly focused on one thing, and that is not to get married during this time. So it looks like it's mourning, but it's, the prohibition is proactive joy, not reactive mourning, right? Not shaving or not taking haircuts or not listening to music, I would call proactive mourning. Proactive joy would be having specific simcha events that are, engaging in very joyful ways. And it seems that the Gaonim only forbid what I would call proactive joy. They didn't legislate proactive mourning. That's pretty clear in all the sources we have seen. Let's turn to the next stage. The Avud Rahom, who is involved with much commentary on the Siddur and on the Minhagim of the Beit Knesset, he also starts off mentioning these ideas of, he is much later, so he starts to include some of the additional prohibitions. The Noagim Miksat Mikamot Lo Lisa Isha De Pesach Atzeret, not to get married between Pesach and Shavuot, Ushalo Lisaper, and not to take haircuts. This is much later, this is hundreds of years later. And the Avud Rahom is now saying that you shouldn't take haircuts also. What's the reason? Because of what happened to Rabbi Akiva's students, etc., etc. If you go to the bottom of source G, you now see, and until now, basically similar to the tradition of many of the Spartan and of actually the Minhag of Chabad and others, and that is that Sfirat HaOmer goes from Pesach till Shavuot, and not just to Lag HaOmer, but if you look here, he says the following, the bottom of source G where I have underlined, the second underline says, V'chein katav ibn Yerichi, Sheshama v'shem harav Zecharia Halevi, Shemata katav, V'sefer yashan haba mitzvah, Shemesu mipetach bat parot ha'teres. They didn't die from Pesach until Shavuot, but until Peros Aseret. What does the word Peros mean? Umay Peros, Palga. It means halfway till. Mitznan Sholim Behofa Pesach Kol Pesach Lamed Yom Upalga Chamisha Aser Yom. You ask a Pesach for 30 days. Upalga is half, is 15 days. Upalga Chamisha Aser Yom Kodem Aseret. Zehu Lagva Omer. In other words, what he's saying is, Palga Aseret means that they didn't die until Shavuot, but rather 15 days before Shavuot, essentially, basically, until Lagva Omer. And thus, the tradition of not mourning until throughout, from Pesach to Shavuot, but either going from Pesach to Shavuot, or from Pesach until Lag HaOmer. Two customs regarding mourning based on the literature, and there are many more that suggest that it's until Lag HaOmer. Okay. So far, what we've seen heretofore, make sure everyone has sources, the people just want things. Okay. So far, we have talked about the idea that the focus is about Rabbi Akiva's students. The earlier stories have 12,000, later stories have 12,000 pairs. The earlier stories don't mention a particular period of time from Pesach to Shavuot. Later stories mention it. And that the Gaonic period and the earlier sources speak about the prohibition of proactive joy, not a prohibition that requires proactive mourning. What's interesting is source 4, Rav Shri Ragon, from the Gaonic period, he writes a history book. And in his history book, he writes the following about Rabbi Akiva's students. Let's just read the one line. He's writing what happened during the Hadrianic persecutions of 135 CE, and he writes the following. Behemid Rabbi Akiva Talmidim Harbe. Rabbi Akiva had many students. And how did they die? Source H. Bahave Shmada al HaTalmidim Shel Rabbi Akiva. And there was a Shmada on the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. What's Shmada mean? Anyone? Shmada? What? Destruction, but it's a particular type of destruction. What?
Massacre.
A massacre is also true, but it's a particular type of massacre, typical type of destruction. Destruction comes from what's the root word of shmada? Shmad. What does shmad mean? Well, it doesn't mean a forceful conversion. It means an anti-Semitic action. Sometimes shmad was to the anti-Semitic action was to forcibly convert them. Bahave shmada. They died at the hands of external enemies who were interested in destroying them. It was an external anti-Semitic act that caused the death of Rabbi Akiva's students. So here you have the history that Rav Shri Ragon writes, who knew Bereshis Rabba, who knew definitely the Talmud, and he introduces another reason for the death of Rabbi Akiva's students. Nothing to do with the reasons that we have discussed heretofore. 12,000 pairs. It's not relevant. He discusses the fact that Rabbi Akiva's students died because of, and by the way, he only says it's 12,000, because of the fact that they were killed by an external enemy. So the question I want to ask you as we unpack this is, what is happening here? You know, when did they die? Why did they die? How did they die? And why do we commemorate their loss? Well, let's look at that for a second. Does everyone understand the questions? Are we okay with the questions? Right? Do you understand what's glaring in the statement of the Gaon, Rav Shura Gaon, who is writing about the destruction of the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva? Do we get that? Do we see how he's inconsistent with all the literature we've all been taught in our lives, and more importantly, the literature that's found in the Midrash and the Talmud? We good? So I'd like to explain the following. I'd like to explain that the fact is that there's some codes here that the Gemara is trying to give us, and there are some important messages that we're trying to communicate. We'll start with the first one that was mentioned about the fact that it doesn't say that there were 24,000, but rather there were 12,000 pairs. You see, Rabbi Akiva was the person who tried to resurrect the second commonwealth of the Jewish people. He wanted to make sure that even after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash in 70 CE, he wanted to re-engage and guarantee the future of the Jewish people by making sure that Medina Israel, the second commonwealth of the Jewish people, stayed around. And therefore, he worked with Bar Kokhba in order to be able to continue the rebellion against Rome. And Rabbi Akiva didn't just use himself, but rather he conscripted all of his students. All the students were involved. And Rabbi Akiva's attempt with Bar Kokhba to maintain the Second Commonwealth, we know, failed. In fact, if you go today, and I would not recommend this, if you go today to the Arab city of Beitar, you will still see the ruins of the Roman encampments around Beitar. I did it once on Tisha B'Av. Trust me, it was a serious mistake, especially to do something like that on Tisha B'Av. But it looks no different than if you see the Roman encampments around Masada. And it's still, to this day, you can still see it as clear as day. what Rav Shmira Gaon is doing is explaining to you the historical reason. First of all, I'm going to show you how all this fits in the text. But I'm just sharing the narrative, and then I'll show you how it fits in the text. Rav Shmira Gaon is telling you, from a historical perspective, Rabbi Akiva's students died because they were generals, officers in Rabbi Akiva's army with Bar Kokhba, and when Bar Kokhba and Rabbi Akiva failed, they died. The Gemara is telling you the reason they died. The reason why the revolt against the Romans failed is because the people involved in the revolt did not have respect for each other. And you cannot guarantee the eternality of the Jewish people when you do not have some internal harmony with each other. The Gemara is not here to be a history book. It does not record every tragedy that happens to the Jewish people. It records tragedies and messages that are eternal. And how do I see this? Let's look at sources, source I. This source I indicates the fact that Rabbi Akiva, in the argument between the rabbis whether Torah scholars should be involved in warfare or not, Rabbi Akiva is of the opinion that Torah scholars must fight in war. So the first thing we know is that in the Hezder movement philosophy question, Rabbi Akiva would be an advocate that one must use Talmudic students to engage in warfare. Source I, Rabbi Akiva Omer, Elach Mata, Elach Mata, Shnei Mata, Elach Mata, Amalomar, L'chol Matot Yisrael Tishlechu Tzavach, to teach you that every tribe has to send to the army, Lahavi et Shifto Shalevi, including Shevet Levi, that were the teachers of the Jewish people, they still need to fight. The first thing we know is that Rabbi Akiva did not believe that the Beis Medrash was removed from engaging in warfare. Here's another piece. Source J, the Yerushalmi. Which, by the way, Rabbi Soloveitchik always used to teach us that when the Rambam has to decide whether using a Babylonian text or a Jerusalem Talmud text in discussing a historical piece, it will always use the Jerusalem Talmud text because Jerusalem Talmud is closer to the historical event. So when the Rambam discusses, for example, Rabbi Bar Kokhba, it does not use the story that's found in the Bavli. It uses the story found in the Yerushalmi of why Bar Kokhba was killed. So in source J, we're told the following. We're told about Tani Rabbi Shimon by Yechai Akiva, Rabbi Haya, he was my Rebbe, and he believed that Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach. We told Akiva, you're wrong. You know, you should realize, Akiva, you will die, and grass will grow from where your cheeks are in your grave before Mashiach comes. And then, here's the line I want to show you. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says, Shmonim elef zug shel tokei kranot hayam akifin et beitar v'chol achad ve'achad hayam memuneh al kama chayalot. This Gemara is telling us how the army of Bar Kokhba was set up. What does it say? What does it say? You tell me. What does it say? 80,000 what? Pair. The way, and by the way, you see this in Josephus also, the way Bar Kokhba's army was set up was leadership was done in pairs, not as one. Leadership was done in pairs. It should say 160,000. What does it say, 80,000 pairs? Because that's the way the leadership structure was. Each pair was in charge of a division of Bar Kokhba's army. This is actually, I think, what the Gemara is trying to pick up on. When it doesn't say 12,000, but it says 12,000 pairs, because it's using the language that is found of Bar Kokhba's army, which was, by the way, not only the way Bar Kokhba's army was led, but armies of that period of time were led, that leadership happens in pairs. And therefore, what's being connected here is the fact that Rabbi Akiva's students, as heads of the army, each one in charge of certain amounts of soldiers, died as zugot, as pairs. And by the way, let's look at source K. Source K tells us something very interesting. He wants to know, what?
No, it doesn't.
Well, this Gemara is saying that he had this many. I don't think we should get, you know, first of all, numbers in the Gemara sometimes mean other things, but this Gemara.
Surrounding
Beit HaMikdash. Yeah, from the inside, not from the outside. V'hayasham ben Kuzva, v'hayalo matayim elef, v'hayasham ben Kuzva. But it doesn't even matter. Even if, by the way, you're 100% correct in your thing, it doesn't change my point. My point is, the way the army structures were set up was that there were that leadership ran in pairs. That's my point. My point is that leadership of armies ran in pairs, not in single groups. That's the point I'm trying to make. The point is that it's not like we're accustomed to now that there is a general and then there's underneath generals, etc., etc., etc. But there was leadership in pairs. And then the next source is asking, when is Gehenim open? Is it a 24/6, 365 day a year type of thing, or is Gehenim open just during certain periods of time in the year? So in Masechta's Idyos, you have Rav Yochanan ben Nuri, who says that Gehenim is actually only open at certain periods of time. When is it? Min Pesach v'ad Aseres, only between Pesach and Shavuot. Why would it be logical to suggest that Gehenim is only open from Pesach to Shavuot? Open for business. That, in other words, it's I don't want to use the childish images of Gehenim, but for this conversation, let's assume that it's a cool 70 degrees all year round, but from Pesach to Shavuot, the heat increases. Right, the air conditioning fails. Okay? Or the feeling of distance of the soul from God, which is really what Gehenna is about, the separation of the soul from its primary source of energy, namely God, the divine, is felt with great intensity from Pesach to Shavuot. Why is it from Pesach to Shavuot? What's unique about from Pesach to Shavuot? That it should be that period of time. They complain in the desert all the time. Jews. There's two things we're good at. We're better at division than multiplication, and we complain a lot. What do you think? It's the time of spiritual development. Actually, Gehenna process is supposed to be a refinement from any spiritual impediments that there were within the soul. And if Pesach to Shavuot is the development of our spirituality, it makes sense that that's the period of time that Gehenna is operational. In fact, if you ever look at a siddur and where you see the counting of the Omer, you'll notice there are Kabbalistic comments on the side because there is the repairing of the various sefirot that are represented each day within the Omer process. It's all about the refinement. So any activity in Gehenim, which is supposed to work on that refinement, no one is eternally damned to Gehenim. It is a process of refinement. Maybe not a comfortable process, but a process of refinement. It makes sense. It happens during this period of time. And therefore, let's look at one more source. Turn to the next page. We're running a little late, so we're going to skip L, but we'll go to M. And that is Siman Lashon Hara. If you want to know why people die from certain things, you should know that if a person dies from Lashon Hara, they're not treating another person with respect when they have the following type of death. What's that death? What does the Gemara say? Source M? A Sakra. What was that? A Sakra? We heard that a Sakra death somewhere, right? Right? That was the Gemara that said they died from a sakura. I think that there are a whole bunch of pieces here that help us understand what Rav Shrira Gaon was doing and what the Gemara was doing. Rav Shrira Gaon was telling you the history. They died because they were fighting a war, and Shmata, they were killed through the Hadrianic persecutions. Nikuda, period. The Gemara is not interested in telling you who shot the arrow. The Gemara is interested in telling you the existential question of why Bar Kokhba and Rabbi Akiva could not achieve their goal. And the answer is because they were working with a group of people that didn't mutually respect each other. You can have the strongest army in the world. If you do not respect each other, the destiny of the Jewish people cannot be guaranteed in an environment in which people do not respect each other. That needs to be commemorated. How can we build families during that period of time if that period of time is representative of a group of great Talmud scholars who could tell you whether it is permitted to eat in Starbucks or not, but could not tell you about whether they could respect each other properly? How can we build families in an environment in which people who knew all of Talmud or the pieces of Talmud that were being discussed at that period of time, but could not treat each other with respect? And therefore the Gemara says they died maybe by the spears of the Romans, but the real reason they died is because they didn't respect each other. And by the way, the same thing happens with Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba dies by the hands of the Romans. But read the Jerusalem Talmud and the Rambam. And the Rambam will say that Bar Kokhba died, based on the Jerusalem Talmud, Neharag ba'avonot. He died because of his sins. It's not that they're arguing with the historical reality. They're just painting the larger picture of why Bar Kokhba failed. That's what's happening here. We need to recognize during this time in which we move from Pesach to Shavuot that the redemption of the Jewish people is compromised when a group of religious personalities cannot respect each other. And the truth is they died throughout the Hadrianic persecution. But the reason why we focus on this between Pesach and Shavuot is for the same reason Gehenna is fully operational according to one approach only during that period of time. Because during this time of spiritual development, one cannot have full spiritual development if we do not treat each other with mutual respect. That's the message. But then there is another message that creeps in to the Sefirat HaOmer paradigm in the Middle Ages. And that is found in Source N, where the Ramah says the following. The Ramah says, Mihu, or Baharbe Mikomot, Noagim Listaper Agrish Kodesh Iyar. There are some that say that you're allowed to take haircuts until Rosh Chodesh Iyar. Va'otam lo yitzparu milag va'omer ve'elech. Afo pisha muta listaper v'lag va'omer v'atzmo. We talked about two different traditions to commemorate the loss of Rosh Chodesh Iyar. Either from Pesach to Shavuot, or Pesach until Peros Aseret, which is until Lag Va'omer. The Ramah is now bringing another one, that we begin to commemorate the loss and the mourning, more active mourning, because post the Onik period, we get additional prohibitions, no live music, no cutting of the hair, no shaving, or at least no shaving, according to some. The Sephardim do not have that tradition whatsoever, and there are traditions that Rabbi Soloveitchik would particularly share with us, and that is to shave before Shabbat, even during this Omer period of time, or permitted to shave totally. But there is this more aggressive mourning process that starts to happen in the Middle Ages, and now you have the Ramah entering another form of period of time from Rosh Chodesh Iyar until right before Shavuot. What is that period of time? It can't be about Rabbi Akiva's students, because all the literature we've seen is either from Pesach to Shavuot or Pesach to Lag BaOmer. Where is this new third paradigm of mourning coming from from Rosh Chodesh Iyar until Shavuos. And by the way, that paradigm is seen in many places. Look at source O. V'yesh mekamot she'ein omrim oto ela be'pesach atzeret. Avarachamim. There are some communities, like the German community, that doesn't say it. A set avarachamim is only said for Pesach atzeret, even if it's Shabbos mevarchim. Like yes, like the Shabbos, we recited avarachamim, even though we omitted. Or the Maharil, who is quoting the German customs, who tells us that in Mainz and in other places, they would say Tachnun even up till Shavuos, because of the fact that there were certain tragedies that happened. Or if you turn to the next page, you'll see again the Shulchan Aruch reminding us that even that you say Avarachamim during Tzvira, and you'll see the Magen Avraham say that even if a source X, that even if a milah happened on Shabbos during this period of time, you should say Avarachamim. And then you see in source number, in source T, you'll see that there are those who suggest you can't even, that you shouldn't cut your nails during Tzvira. And if you look at source, again, I want to get to a point, so I'm skipping, I'm going through these pretty fast. Source U, you'll see that the Sefer Ropeach, Reb Ben Yehuda of Worms, writes the following: the worms mitanim al zeirah shahaya v'Rosh Chodesh Nisan Sivan. In Worms, we had a fast day on Rosh Chodesh Sivan. But nagu lekro v'shachrid for Rosh Chodesh ul'erev v'yachal, and they didn't read the standard reading for Rosh Chodesh; they read v'yachal. And look at the Sefer Minhag, who lived in the 1200s. Bottom of this page, source V. Umin ha'tov, shelo l'tzaper, u'shelo yichanet tzus, v'shum davar chadash. There's a minhag, not to wear new clothing, not to take haircuts. And he adds another thing, u'litaneg v'merchat, or to shower, v'asos sipranav, or to cut your nails, me'achar pesach ad atzeres, from Pesach until Shavuos, l'chvod ha-chassidim ha-tmimim ba-yisharim shen-masru nafsham atmam al-kidush kidushat Hashem. Where does that language come from, by the way? Avarachamim. And Yisker. Right? Where is this coming from? By the way, you only see this amongst the Ashkenazim. The Sephardic traditions, as you get further and further from Germany, geographically, you see less of what I would call proactive mourning. What is happening here? What is this mourning all about? Is it also about the Rebbe Akiva story? Or is there another overlay of mourning that connects with this issue? Anyone? The Crusader period. It is the destruction that happens to the Ashkenazic community. If you turn to the final source, in the First Crusades and afterwards in 1096, where Worms, Speyer, and Mainz and their communities are devastated, where for the first time in Jewish history, you see a group of poskim struggling with the fact that Jews are not only killing themselves, but they are killing their children. They are killing their children in order to make sure that they are not captured by the Crusades and forced to convert. Where Tosfos and Avodah Zarah, and you don't have the source with you, speaks about the idea of mitzvah l'chado v'atmo, that is permitted for one to injure oneself. Or the ritva in Avodah Zarah that's chilling. U'mikan lomdim l'shchot hana'arim zeirot b'vnei havarat hadat. From here we learn, from the story of Rav Chanina ben Tzraja, that it is permitted to murder your children in order to stop them from being converted. Behem devarim tzrichim tamud v'iyun gadol. And this requires great reflection and introspection. Elakvar hura zakein. But the greatest Tosafist, the eldest Tosafist, who is who? Anyone know? Rabbeinu Tam, said that that's what you're supposed to do. Sheitiru kein halacha l'maitza. Who passed in that way. Or the Tosfos Rav Elchanan, who was the Talmud of the Reed, who says, the Shari u Mitzvahi, that it is permitted and it's a mitzvah. And Dr. Soloveitchik has a whole course in which he deals with the fact that post this traumatic situation, you have the Rishonim dealing with the fact that Jews killed not only themselves but their children, or the challenge that the Maharam in Wittenberg deals with in the tshuva, in which someone asks, how do I do tshuva when I killed my children, I killed my wife, I was about to kill myself, and I was stopped from doing that in the Crusader period, and the challenges that go with that. How do I need to do tshuva? This is a totally different type of mourning process. And therefore, in the Ashkenazi community, there was now proactive mourning. He found this. And by the way, I want to tell you, and this is not the time for us to get into this, but after this period of time, you can see the Gemaras of the Rabbi Akiva story, of when Rabbi Akiva dies, Rabbi Akiva is martyred. You can see the manuscripts of the Gemara post the First Crusade. They're different than the manuscripts of the Gemaras pre the First Crusade. The post-Crusader manuscripts highlight the ideas that Rabbi Akiva says, I cannot wait till this happens.